Welcome, everyone, to episode 357 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a loaded show for you today. We're going to catch up on all four of the conference semifinal series, and we will also discuss Steve Nash's unexpected return to the NBA. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is not my co-host Morten Jensen, who is not feeling well, although he did test negative for COVID, so it is not that. Instead, I am joined by Anthony Irwin, the host of Locked On Lakers. Anthony, how's it going, my man?
I didn't mean to laugh. I was just not anticipating that at all. So I'm happy to hear that, Morten is doing all right. I was just not at all prepared for that sentence. I'm doing good, though, man. How are you holding up?
I'm doing well. Yeah, Mort had a brief COVID scare. He was exposed last weekend to someone at work who had it. So he's been in quarantine up until today, actually. He's been quarantined in his bedroom all week. But yeah, he had the test Thursday, got the results back today, and he is negative. So he is free to roam about his apartment again, which is which is a big win. Anthony, since you are a Lakers guy, let's start with that series. Lakers Rockets started last night. The Rockets jumped out to a 1-0 series lead. And I'll be honest, man, I was too busy shit posting about the Bucks that I at least missed like the first half of this game. So what stood out to you about, you know, it was 112-97. What stood out to you about how the Rockets played and Lakers played?
Playoffs Rondo, baby.
He's back.
I mean, look, they say that playoff Rondo wins basketball games. They just aren't specific about who he wins them for, is the thing. So, look, we always see this all the time across sports where a team that is rolling, whether it's in the postseason, you know, a couple of years ago, I'm a Vikings fan, right? And a couple of years ago, they had Teddy Bridgewater, who they invested a first-round pick on and is, you know, still in the league. He had just gotten back healthy. They were thinking, okay, they'll work him back in. They were still in the regular season, but they were winning. So they stuck with the quarterback who I've since forgotten. But they stuck with him, and you wound up winning a couple of playoff games. Now, neither of them are on the Vikings, but the point here is that, like, usually the team that is rolling doesn't do much to alter the rotation so long as they're winning, especially for, like, unless it's for a superstar, right? Unless it's for, like, if LeBron James come back, okay, yeah, you probably want to get him back in the rotation and reconfigure things a little bit. But for Rajon Rondo, that is not the kind of player that you want to mess with rotations against, especially given, like, the Lakers are already at a mathematical disadvantage against Houston. And to now shrink that margin for error even further by bringing somebody on who actively hurts you every second that he's on the court and in multiple ways on both sides of the ball, like, that's just making your life a hell of a lot harder to the point where I'm not even positive the Lakers can win this series anymore.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, it comes down to, like, Houston, because of the way that they play, right, they are going to score more points per possession than the Lakers. They're going to shoot three-pointers compared to the Lakers' two-pointers. And because of that, the Lakers have to generate more possessions per game than Houston does. Offensive rebounds, keeping the ball secure, right? Stuff like that. Neither of which Rajon Rondo helps you with. And also, while he's doing that, he's going to gum up the key for Anthony Davis. He's going to gum up the key for LeBron James in the few minutes that they share together. And, like, there are some ways that you could explain last night, like Alex Caruso gets into foul trouble, and thus maybe Rondo was forced into a bigger role. And then, like, he played all of the fourth quarter because the game was over by the time they got to the fourth quarter. And so you go through all of these things, and it's just tough to put yourself in that situation when you don't have to. Like, Vogel talked after the game, and he was saying, you know, it's really tough to bring a player back into a playoff series when you're in the second round of the playoffs. It's like, dude, you don't have to. You have an option here. The option here is just to, like, roll with what got you here.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, you know, some of the talking points after the game, LeBron was saying, you know, one, we just needed, you can, like, see their speed on film, but mm-hmm. it's hard to get used to it until you actually play it. You know, they had 17 turnovers as a team, and they all mentioned that as something they can't do, especially given, you know, the Rockets are a good transition team, and then also, like, they aren't afraid to pull up from three in transition, which is, mm-hmm. you know, the math problem that you mentioned. The rebounding battle was even, 41-41.
Which means the Lakers lost.
Right, right. So, I mean, it seems like, kind of looking ahead to game two, one of the big questions, other than does Rajon Rondo play at all, is, like, schematically, do you shift to what the Rockets are doing, and do you go small and put Anthony Davis more at the five, or do you keep these two big lineups, which actually worked pretty well in game one?
Well, this might be the topic that ends Lakers Twitter once and for all, because you have you have loud voices on both sides of the equation. The one thing I would say, because the guy who's been the loudest about whether or not, you know, the Lakers keeping two bigs on the court has been Krangis, and he's hammering mm-hmm. home that, like, this is something that they have to do. They have to keep those two Laker bigs on the lineup. Look at the numbers while those bigs are out there. Well, of Rondo's 25 minutes last night, 21 of them came with one big on the court. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say, look at how great the Lakers bigs, or look how great the Lakers looked when they had two bigs out there on the court. And it's like, well, yeah, they don't have the worst player in the NBA right now out there with them as you know, 20% of the equation there. And so I personally basically look at it this way. The playoffs are all about teams finding things that you cannot do and then forcing you to do those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So with the Bucks, Miami has somehow convinced Mike Budenholzer that he cannot play Giannis more than 35 minutes a game. And they are going right. to force him to do that, and Mike Budenholzer is not going to do it. But for the Lakers, what the Lakers should do, and I think this is going to be their approach, is the one thing the Houston Rockets cannot do is grow mid-series, right? Mm-hmm. They cannot get bigger. So if the Lakers can make those minutes work and keep JaVale on the court and keep Dwight Howard on the court and minimize the impact that PJ Tucker and Robert Covington have, that's how you win the series. Like, that's the easiest way to take care of this series quickly. If that doesn't happen, though, and this is where they have to have a quicker hook, I think, like, Dwight Howard was miserable last night. And even for stretches, it looked like JaVale McGee was one of those wacky arm flailing guys that was just getting pushed all over the court by everybody who was smaller than him and have a lower center of gravity. If it looks like those guys are struggling, then I'm sorry, Anthony Davis. You actually have to do the thing that makes your team better more often than not, and that's play the five. And I think even there, though, like, when they play Anthony Davis at the five, it seems like the compromise they make is, I know you don't like playing at the five, but what if we give you post touches? And that's kind of how they do the trade-off. But you can't do that. Like, that's the one way you don't beat the Rockets, is by allowing PJ Tucker, who's built like a fire hydrant, to just stand there and try to get punished in the post. That's, you can't do that. Even, like, everybody thinks James Harden's this bad defender, he's one of the best defenders in the NBA at guarding in the post. So these situations that look like matchup issues actually aren't. And so for the Lakers, they got to play Anthony Davis, I think, at the five if Dwight Howard and JaVale don't have it going. But when they play him at the five, they still have to get him on the move. They got to put him in pick-and-roll situations, mm-hmm. handoff situations, get him cutting to the basket more often so that you can allow P.J. Tucker, or not allow P.J. Tucker, to set his feet and square his shoulders as a defender.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes total sense. I know Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports had the report out today that Davis is willing to play the five, so that's step one.
Way to go, Dave. But thanks, Anthony. I appreciate that, bud.
Great, good, good. I'm glad the Max player is willing to make some meaningful sacrifice in helping his team win. Great start. But no, I think you're totally right in that, you know, it feels like a mismatch given the size advantage that Davis has over Tucker. But, you're right about you don't want to be posting him up against Tucker or Harden. I think we're seeing it a little bit in the Celtics-Raptors series where, you know, again, sometimes you'll see, like, Tatum posting up against one of the smaller guards, like Kyle Lowry or Fred VanVleet, gets switched onto him. Yeah. And instead of you've got the size advantage, you could back him down, but, you know, that gives the Raptors a chance to recover defensively. Instead, he just turns around and pulls up and drains a shot right over him. Like, you have a 6-inch, 7-inch height advantage over these guys. Mm-hmm. You are a good mid-range shooter. You are allowed to take those shots. And, you know, we saw one in the second quarter last night where AD was trying to post up PJ Tucker and then, like, turned around and hit a ridiculous, like, fadeaway jumper from mid-range, which is not exactly a high efficiency shot. He hit it, but I think that shot is going to be there for him throughout this series.
Yeah, one official stat that I'm keeping track of with Anthony Davis in this one is in games that Mark Jackson is calling them, when he makes a shot, Mark Jackson says, "That's a shot you're okay with." Like every single time Anthony Davis makes that fadeaway jumper, Mark Jackson says, "If you're the Houston Rockets, you just play your defense, and that's a shot you got to live with." And I agree completely. That's an absolutely salient point. And you know, for things to be so obvious that Mark Jackson gets it, that should like, that should be the thing that like wakes the Lakers up and says, "Okay, all right, maybe we should change things up a bit." And the thing too is that, like, what really kind of frustrated me about last night's game, and I think like Alex Caruso talked after the game, how it was hard for them to zero in on the Rockets because they weren't sure that they were going to have to face the OKC Thunder, which they very well could have, right? My thing there, though, is that you had like 5 months of downtime. In that downtime, you could have identified the things that made you successful against the Houston Rockets so that, like, just in case you face them in the playoffs, you have that to be able to lean on. So I'm not really here for the excuses there. And they do have some very lengthy stretches where they were successful against Houston, and it was by an aerial attack. It was by, you know, LeBron is a couple inches taller than the person who's going to be guarding him. Anthony Davis is like 6 inches taller than the people who are going to be guarding him. JaVale McGee, Dwight Howard, both of those guys are going to have about half a foot on whoever is guarding them. Throw the ball over the top. Force this game to be played at 13 feet high, right? A couple feet above the rim, because that's the one place Houston cannot get to. And the way that you make it easier on them, like, think about it. When somebody is posting up, the ball is usually sitting at like 3 feet above the ground. Everybody on the court can get to that thing. Like, there's not a person on the court, and especially the Rockets, who are about that height anyway. Like, they can. That's an advantage that you're giving to the Rockets. So I just think for where the Lakers are sitting right now, you have to be able to take advantage of your advantages.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. I guess, and you said already that, you know, you're now a little worried that the Lakers can't or won't win this series moving forward. What do you think? I mean, aside from getting Rondo out of the rotation, what do you think the keys are to game two for them to get back in this thing?
So aside from the Rondo stuff, because that is the key first and foremost. Like, if any game that the Lakers play where he plays more than, I'd say, 20 minutes, you're running in. You're probably losing that game. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I think as a general key to the Lakers, they're like in baseball. What teams will a lot of times do is they'll line up, or they'll intentionally have a flamethrower coming out of the bullpen after, you know, somebody who doesn't throw as hard as their starting pitcher is on the mound. And what that does is it just completely throws off your timing. And for the Lakers here, that's essentially what they're facing. They're coming off a series against the Portland Trailblazers where they're essentially, like, if you're to just going to try to equate them to a style of pitcher, they're knuckleballers. Like, they throw the ball 75 miles an hour as a team-wide defense. They aren't very aggressive in passing lanes. Like, there aren't very many elite defenders on their team. Whereas you look at Houston, and they're always up in passing lanes. They're always, you know, really pushing and really forcing the issue in terms of speed on the court. They do have a couple of elite situational defenders. And the Lakers here, and LeBron talked about this afterward, was just saying they have to get used to that speed. And the sooner they get acclimated to that speed and you see it show up in some of the dumb turnovers, shots that are rushed that didn't have to be shot or that didn't have to be rushed. Once they kind of figure that aspect of it out, I do think even despite Rondo, they'll be the better team. But, mm-hmm. I still think, though, if you're playing Rondo 20-ish minutes a game, you are really thinning that margin for error down to a point where you're making things way too easy on Houston.
Yeah, and I'd say one thing to keep an eye out from Houston's perspective is Daniel House left the game, I think, in the third quarter, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if we've gotten an update on his status today. Like, based on the eye test, he seemed like he was concussed, which would suggest...
Well, that was weird, right? Because they were talking about how, like, they are going to hold him out of the game for precautionary reasons, but they don't have him in the concussion protocol. How does that even work? Like, what are you holding? Like, if you're being cautious about something and it's about a concussion, then how does that not have him in the concussion protocol?
Right. Yeah. I'm curious to see if we get any update today, like, that he does confirm to have a concussion or not. I mean, hopefully he's fine and that he doesn't. And I don't want to say they're, like, nefarious and would hide it, because I don't think they could even do that if they wanted to at this point. But if he is forced to miss time, I mean, that takes away, A wing defender from them. But B, like, I mean, they've got, you know, Jeff Green, Austin Rivers have both been playing well off the bench. House has too. Ben McLemore made an impact, especially during the regular season, hasn't really played much in the playoffs. But, you know, their depth would take a hit if House is out. So then we could be looking at really a Rockets team that only goes seven deep. So, if you're a Lakers fan, that is something to keep an eye on, because that, coming off of a seven game series, I would think as this series progresses further, fatigue could be a factor. So if you're running a rotation that thin, we could start to see the Rockets run out of gas a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I first and foremost, I really hope he's healthy, just because as somebody who has had a concussion, it is like the next morning is awful. Mm-hmm. It feels like the hangover of all hangovers. So I do hope to get some clarity just from a medical standpoint for Daniel House in his own regard. And Mike D'Antoni, like you talked about, usually runs a pretty short rotation. And as a result, you lose one of those guys and it really throws off how that rotation is going to look. And while McLemore was a cool story in the regular season, the playoffs is usually where those cool stories kind of go to die. and that's, I think, how that would probably go with McLemore.
Yeah, I agree with that. So Anthony, as much as the Lakers could be a big story in a couple games, I think we need to move to the biggest story really in the NBA right now, the Milwaukee Bucks, who were among the title favorites all season, you know, had the best record in the NBA all year, was on a 70-win pace, came into the bubble as one of the title favorites. They are down 3-0 to the Miami Heat in the second round. They would have to be the first team in NBA history to ever overcome such a deficit to advance. And I mean, I think the big storyline beyond, like, the stupid is Giannis a Pippen instead of a Jordan, it's Mike Budenholzer, man. Is he, like, actively trying to throw the series at this point?
If I had money on Milwaukee, I would probably say so.
You know? Right? I mean, I think Mort is genuinely sick today, but I also think he called out sick because he knew I was going to slander Bud like this. We had a discussion going into the playoffs where, you know, I brought this up as like, this is my biggest concern about the Milwaukee Bucks. It's not the talent on their roster. It's like, is Mike Budenholzer, if they go down in the series, is he going to make the necessary adjustments? Because we have not seen it in his playoff past. And I mean, lo and behold, it's not just the minutes. The minutes distribution is also wacky. Like, he's giving quotes where he's talking about, like, I don't know if we could play Giannis and Chris more than 35, 36 minutes. Kyle Lowry played 46 minutes in game three.
Noted, like Giannis is on his... He's talking about Giannis as if he's, like, on his last legs.
Right!
Like, you know, really pushing it. He's just at this advanced age in his career. No, what?
I mean... Like, in his defense, Giannis did clearly roll his ankle early in game three. And, you know, they were referencing it on the broadcast throughout the game. Like, he was grimacing at times, especially after making big plays. Giannis downplayed it after the game, said he could have been playing more. But I think it is fair to assume Giannis is not 100% at this point. That does not explain Chris Middleton's minutes. That does not explain Wesley Matthews' minutes. Like, what is going on in this series? Like, my question is... If you switch nothing else about these teams except for the coaches, Bud is on the Heat, Spo is on the Bucks. What is this series at right now?
I mean, it's a sweep, right?
I think so.
You have to think that the better team, because Milwaukee has been the better team all year, better team with the better coach, and not just the better coach, but going up a coach that refuses to adjust. It's one thing to, like, not see the adjustments. It's one thing to, you know, maybe be slow on the uptick. But just to just outright and dogmatically refuse to adjust given the different situation between regular season basketball and postseason basketball. Like, that's actively hurting your team. And you know, I usually tend to think of coaches like this. I think you have your handful of legitimately great coaches at the top of the league that can go out and win you a basketball game. Mm-hmm. You have the objectively awful coaches, right? The Luke Waltons, the, you know, Mark Jacksons, right. The Jason Kidds of the world, where they will lose you a bunch of games. And then the vast majority of the coaches, though, are in this kind of amoebic middle range where all you're hoping for them is do not cost me games. That's it. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to notice you. I don't want to think about you. Kind of like referees, right? Those middling coaches, you want to think of them as like referees, where I don't even think about that referee until after the game you realize, hey, that referee did a pretty good job, or hey, that coach did a pretty solid job this game. And here with Mike Budenholzer, who is a very good regular season coach and is now a very bad postseason coach, you have to get to this point where, you know, you have to stop costing us games. And I don't know that he can. I don't know that he's so stubborn and stuck in his ways, which is so weird because he isn't some, like, aged coach. He's not right. Phil Jackson. He's not, you know, Greg Popovich. He's been in the league for he's been in the league for a while. But as a head coach, he's only been in the league for – what, like maybe 7-8 years now? And like at that point, it's not an old dog and new tricks kind of thing. It's just a dog that refuses to stop shitting on the bed. Or sorry.
you're totally right though. I mean, I think our mutual friend Matt Moore of the Action Network wrote a really good piece yesterday, you know, before game three, digging into like what is going on here, why does he refuse to adjust? And you know, part of the conclusion that Matt reached was, well, I mean, they were so dominant during the regular season that part of you wants to just stick with what brought you here, and that makes sense. Like, you're going to trust percentages will even out and, you know, something will regress to the mean. Jay Crowder won't continue to shoot 90% from three. You know, they're playing good defense on Duncan Robinson. That's great. But at the same time, you know, his unwillingness to adjust in the playoffs, I think, stems from part of the regular season too, where if you don't experiment during the regular season, like if you are a playoff team, if you know you have the talent to be a playoff team, you should treat the regular season as 82 games of experimentation. Yeah. Which lineups work best, which players mesh well with other players, what counters and counterpunches can we develop now that when the playoffs come and a team takes away our first option, we have something else to fall back on. And, you know, the Bucks all year were they played their drop coverage and defense and dared shooters to beat them, and they, you know, tried to focus on the good shooters and leave some of the bad shooters uncovered. The bubble has not been kind to that because everyone is a good shooter in the bubble. And then offensively, it's, you know, drive Giannis through a wall and hope he can figure something out or kick it out to a shooter. And it's just not working against the Heat, but they don't seem to have a counterpunch.
Well, like I was actually thinking about writing about this. It's been a while since I've written anything. And basically, the comment that you always hear about the regular season in the NBA, and maybe across like all of non-football sports, is that the season is so long and these games don't even mean anything. And gosh, why should I care about Lakers Nets on a Tuesday night, you know? And mm-hmm. if you're just looking at it from a perspective of like which team has the best record at the end of the year, who scored the most points over the course of that year, who got the most block steals, etc. That aspect of the regular season is completely useless. We could have a well shortened NBA season. But like you're saying is the absolute correct point here, where the smart teams will sometimes cost themselves losses just to develop a curveball. Mm-hmm. You know, just to develop an option to be able to go to when your best play, best set, best, you know, even identity is you know, you're forced to alter that identity. And you know, the Bucks are a tremendous regular season team. They just go out there and slaughter teams doing things that they cannot, that most teams don't have an ability. Oh, the dog above me is going insane. the most teams aren't able to stop, and especially teams. And now here comes my dog to chime in. I'm sorry, man. But you know, for in a regular season, when a team only has like a couple days or maybe a few hours before the game to really tune into the things that they have to do to have success against that team, that's fine. It's great. You're going to win a ton of regular season games. But in the postseason, where a team has hours and days, and even, you know, over the course of a postseason series, weeks, you know, mm-hmm. to be able to find ways to make it difficult to do those things that made you really successful in the regular season, that's when you have to have developed some kind of experience throwing that counterpunch. And unfortunately, and Ben Thompson made this point yesterday. He's the Bucks fan that, you know, he's one of my favorite fans because he's this like super logical and reasoned person everywhere else, but then with his box he's just a nutcase. but he said the thing, he made the point where it's even if they try to throw a counterpunch right now, even if they tried to adjust other than playing Giannis more minutes, even if they tried to do something different, they would make mistakes doing so because they haven't done it at any point in the season. So yeah, this mm-hmm. is a long way to make the point you made a second ago, where the regular season doesn't matter if you're just thinking about seeding and win totals and those kinds of things. Where it's very important and where the smart teams use it the best is to develop themselves as the kind of team that becomes more difficult to guard in a postseason setting.
Right. Yeah. Like you just need to be more well-rounded. You can't be a one-trick pony, no matter how good that trick is, because again, that, you know, the Bucks were on a 70 win pace all year. This is not to take away anything from how good they were during the regular season. This is not to call them frauds, because, you know, I saw the tweet from Kevin O'Connor last night. It was like, let's be honest, the Heat are the more talented team. They're the better team. And I don't agree with that. I think the Bucks are the more talented team. We're just seeing, you know, as you said, we're seeing Spo. I think he is in that tier of coaches who can actively win you games. I think it's like guys like him and Nick Nurse and Brad Stevens are all up there. And right now, Bud is in the Luke Walton tier, where it's like, not in the regular season, Bud is fine. He won Coach of the Year last year. He deserved it. He was in the mix this year as well. All good. But when it comes to the postseason, we see this year after year after year. And, you know, now you have to look ahead. And I don't want to, like, go down the speculative, like, oh, this Giannis is going to leave. Where is he going to go in 2021? But if you're the Bucks, you know, you have – if Giannis doesn't sign that Supermax deal this offseason, you definitely have to worry about his future. And you can't – you know, regardless of when they get knocked out, they are – almost certainly going to get knocked out in this round. You can't feel good about that. So you've got to presumably make at least some material change to convince Giannis that we will have a better chance next year. So, I mean, I feel like Bud is legitimately on the hot seat here, but then you run into the issue of, like, are you sure the next coach is going to be any better?
Well, what's tough is that the kind of coaches that they might have been interested in, because of them being in the playoffs, they aren't going to have access to Ty Lue, right? They aren't going to have access to, like, maybe if you're all in on Tom Thibodeau for some reason, they aren't going to have access to him. So for where the Bucks are sitting, I don't really know. You know, you're right. They do have to make some change there, and I will say this, I don't think it can get any worse in the postseason than Bud. Like, it doesn't matter who they could hire just about anybody, and I feel pretty confident in saying that should that team arrive in a postseason, they'll be better than they are with Mike Budenholzer coaching. And like, can you imagine a happier scene than Eric Spoelstra and his coaching staff reading the quotes from Mike Budenholzer saying they aren't going to play Giannis right. more minutes? Like, they're all in the same building, you would think. So I'm sure that, like, are the rings of laughter making their way across the hallway. So, like, can Mike Budenholzer hear Eric Spoelstra and his coaching staff laughing at Mike Budenholzer for saying he's not going to play Giannis more minutes? I think, like, without going the whole, you know, Giannis future Laker or Giannis future Heat or anything like that, I do think we've reached this point where you have to roll the dice there, and you can do so fairly confidently, because I just don't think it gets much worse than playoff Bud.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, on the Ty Lue point, you know, the Sixers have been pretty heavily linked to him. There was a report Thursday that got walked back that they were closing in on a deal on him. But now I'm wondering, like, Ty Lue is not an idiot. Like, he sees what's going on
here.
He's got to know the Bucks are probably going to make a change at this point. And, you know, I said that on Twitter last night, and I had a couple of Sixers fans reply, and were like, well, are we sure the Bucks are a more attractive destination than the Sixers? I'm like,
yes.
Did you watch the Sixers this year? Of course they are. You know, I get the whole, like, Giannis could leave in a year. Sure, that's true. But the Bucks are an objectively better team right now. You could probably convince him to stay if you win a title next year. And either way, you get paid if you get fired if you're a coach. So, like, Ty Lue probably doesn't give a damn if Giannis leaves at 21, because he's still getting that paycheck either way.
The Bucks do not have the gross domestic product or produce or whatever it is. going to Al Horford, Joel Embiid, and Ben Simmons, who all probably play, you know, either the four or the five, and cannot play together.
Yep.
So, I'm sorry, Sixers fans, but the Bucks, even with Giannis potentially leaving, and also, by the way, if you're Ty Lue and you win a championship and you keep Giannis in Milwaukee when he, you know, might potentially already have a foot out the door, then you are a made man, and you can basically, you know, demand any kind of contractual obligation in your following contract. So the upside is insane. And like you're saying, the downside is, okay, I coach 1 year of Giannis, and then I get to coach a rebuilding situation where I basically am going to be hired for a long period of time because rebuilds tend to take a while.
Right. Right. Yeah. I do not think this was a close contest, and I rained some cold water on some Sixers fans yesterday who seemed to have a much higher opinion of their future than they should.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's now pivot into Raptors Celtics, because for all of the slander that we are throwing at the Bucks right now, we were 0.5 seconds from doing the same thing about the Toronto Raptors. Kemba Walker, I mean, it's genuinely unfair that highlight is now going to be buried because of what OG Anunoby did. Because, I mean, he threw just an absolute dime to Daniel Theis for a go-ahead basket, left 0.5 seconds left on the clock. And then, you know, we're right back to the coaching point. Nick Nurse draws up an incredible play, causes some confusion on the Celtics end. OG Anunoby gets wide open for a game-winning three. Is now 104-103 the Celtics, and we have a series on our hands, because, you know, game two of this series was also came down to the wire. I think these are two evenly matched teams, and they have, this is not a Spo versus Bud thing. They have two great coaches as well. So what is your feeling? Like, what's your read on this series?
Well, OG's shot is the kind of thing that swings series, you know. Boston was this close. Think about this. If Daniel Theis takes a dribble, that game's over.
Yeah.
He had enough time to kind of take his time under the basket and make sure that's an outright buzzer beater, or at least hold the ball for like 0.2 more seconds so that no Raptor could literally have enough time to catch and actually release a shot. So and I'm not even blaming Theis, by the way. I'm just saying this is the margin for error that you see in playoff basketball, that somehow dunking the ball with 0.5 seconds was somehow not holding the ball long enough to be able to fully put away the opponent. But for how I feel about the series, I always thought it was going to be an incredibly close one. The two teams are incredibly well matched against each other. I like that we get this kind of, you know, in the Western Conference, we have Rockets, Lakers, where the styles make the fights, and that they are so, you know, on opposite ends of the spectrum against each other. But then you go to the East and you have very similar organizational approaches between the Celtics and the Raptors. So I think, you know, the Celtics, I still think, are probably the better team and will probably still win this series. But it's also going to be tough if you're Boston to be that close to being up 3-0 and having the series all but over, to now only one loss away from a three-game series.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it feels like going into this series, I was basically like, did not have a good read on who was going to win. I just said, I hope it goes seven, because I think these are two pretty evenly matched teams. And I was surprised that, you know, I would not have expected the Celtics to go up 3-0. I'm glad that the Raptors got to extend this thing at least a little bit. Like, for all we know, the Celtics are going to win the next two, and it's not going to mean much in the long run, as you said. But I have been intrigued. You know, the same day I thought that this whole, like, is Giannis a Pippen instead of Jordan conversation came up, I thought it was pretty interesting that Pascal Siakam has been struggling to the extent that he has in this series, and he's not falling under that same spotlight. And this is not meant as an insult to Pascal Siakam. I think really one of the things that these playoffs have underscored to me is just the importance of, like, guards and wings who can initiate their own offense. And I feel like we learn this lesson every single year in the playoffs, but guys like Kawhi Leonard, Jimmy Butler, LeBron James, you know, they could go 80% during the regular season, but then when the playoffs come, like, their ability to create offense for themselves and others make them so much more valuable than, you know, some bigs like Joel Embiid or even Anthony Davis at times, or, you know, Nikola Jokic or Pascal Siakam in this point. So, I mean, Siakam got cover because Kyle Lowry was fantastic in game three. Again, 31 points, 8 assists, 6 rebounds. And, hey, Mike Budenholzer, he played 46 minutes and is still fine. Yeah. Newsflash. But, yeah, I am interested to see, you know, I think this was the concern about the Raptors going into the series was, you know, you, obviously you don't have Kawhi Leonard anymore, so who is your creator in the half court? Can it be Siakam? You know, can you run post-ups through Siakam? Is that going to be a winning strategy against a Celtics team that has Jaylen Brown, who's done a phenomenal job on him defensively throughout this series? And so far the answer is no, but, you know, this is the good thing, and this is the fun thing about this series, is, like, I trust Nick Nurse to make that adjustment and say, like, all right, you know what? Pascal Siakam post-ups are not our path to success. I'm not going to run them as much anymore, instead of, like, forcing 20 down your throat every single game despite results showing we should not be doing this.
I always kind of thought, dating back to last year, that we would eventually get to this point with Siakam, because, like, he blossomed in a role, and it, like, he was seen as the second best player, even though I always thought that was kind of a more rotational role, where on some nights Van Vliet is going to be on fire, and some nights Kyle Lowry is going to be great, and some nights, you know, some other role player with the Raptors is going to come through. Maybe Siakam would be the second best player in more situations than anybody else on the roster, but I didn't think that it was going to be, you know, all right, now Kawhi is gone, Pascal, good luck. You know, I just didn't think that was going to be the situation that was going to be best for him, especially postseason time. And it's because of what we talked about earlier with Milwaukee. He doesn't, his game isn't particularly polished, so he doesn't have very many counterpunches. He doesn't have, you know, if the defense adjusts to him, you know, if they anticipate the spin move and start taking charges on it, he doesn't really have very many other options that he can comfortably go to. And that's not really a fault of his own to this point. He's still relatively new to the league in this, especially in this role. So I'm more disappointed in Nick Nurse and his offensive coaching than Pascal Siakam as a player, because Nick Nurse is seen as, like, one of, if not the best coach in the NBA. And you watch their offense and it's pretty, you know, pretty straightforward. There's not very much movement to it. And come postseason time, if you don't have a primary creator in the way that, you know, the Lakers have LeBron, that was a Freudian slip. in the way that other teams have, you know, whether it's Steph or, you know, go on down the line, the Raptors don't have that. So you would think that they would systematically make up for it with more movement and a more robust system offensively to try to make up for it. And I've been kind of disappointed with that. That said, because Nurse is so good, I don't think they have enough time to just implement a system. I do think they'll find more ways to get him going. It's always weird to me. Like, Giannis is another guy. Put him in a pick and roll, you know. Mm-hmm. Put Siakam in a pick and roll and get him slipping and diving and cutting to the basket, because that was the ways that he was so effective playing alongside Kawhi. And so, like, if they can find a way to do that and make it so that when he catches the ball, the Celtics aren't all just keyed in on a stationary basketball, then I think, you know, he'll see a little bit more success.
Yeah, it did seem like he was starting to get going a little bit toward the end of game three. So I think you're right. Nick Nurse will scheme ways for him to get, you know, better chances instead of just posting up or spotting up at the three-point line and trying to catch a shoot all the time. I think part of this is personnel limitation. You know, Ananobi, as great as he is defensively, he's pretty one-dimensional offensively. And, you know, again, this is, like, you said it earlier, in the playoffs, you can really harp in on your opponent's weaknesses. So you can you know you're not like gonna get killed by Ananobi driving kicks or like Ananobi, you know, like being the focal point of your offense. And Marc Gasol is, you know, he is what he is at this point. Great passer. He can knock down some open shots, but again, you're not gonna run your offense through him. So I think the Raptors are a little bit more predictable offensively than the Celtics, where you've got Tatum, Brown, Walker, and Smart, all of whom can, you know, create on their own, but also serve as facilitators when need be.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're right. You know, you would like to see the Raptors be more like the 2014 Spurs, where it's like, you don't know where it's coming from, but someone's going to destroy you every night. And it's like, it could be Lowry one game, Siakam one game, Van Vliet one game. I mean, I just don't know if they have the firepower necessarily to topple the Celtics, but you know, like Ibaka only had 2 points on 1 of 6 shooting. He could be that guy. He could pop off for 20 points in one of these games. Norman Powell too, he had 8 points in game 3 in only 15 minutes, but like he might need to get going a little bit more as well. So I still don't have a great read on this series. I just feel like the Celtics have been the better team so far, but as you said, you know, that OG shot could really lift the Raptor sails and like deflate the Celtics a little bit. It really could be the pivot point of this series.
Yep. I agree completely. I mean, the Celtics series just have, you know, dips and turns and loop-de-loops all the time. And right. a shot like that in an Obi one where the Celtics are riding high thinking that they just had a walk-off slam dunk and then get punched with the perfect outlet pass over Taco Fall and right into an OG Ananobi, who I don't think had made a shot in like 24 game minutes to that point. So you go from the highs of feeling like you just won a playoff game and are now on your way to potentially sweeping this really good opponent to damn. You know, just damn.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's finish with the last playoff series, and then we'll get into Nash quickly. I honestly don't even have that much to say about Clippers Nuggets. It was 120-97, just an absolute blowout, really, from the second quarter onward. This is one of these series that, you know, going in, I thought the Clippers would have a tougher time with the Mavs than I did the Nuggets. I think, The Clippers don't have an obvious way to counter Nikola Jokic, but I think they're okay with that because that means, yeah, you know, they're gonna shut down Jamal Murray. They have Patrick Beverley, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard. Like, Jamal Murray was a dynamo in that first round series against Utah. I think he's in for a really rough series here. Do you see the Nuggets having any chance of making this thing competitive, or do you think it's, you know, probably looking at Clippers in 4, Clippers in 5 here?
I have like a somewhat odd number of Nuggets fan friends on, you know, in covering the league. Whenever I've been going to Las Vegas Summer League, I've been staying at what has essentially become like the Nuggets house, the Nugget Blogger house. And it's been, I mean, you talk to them and they all kind of know how this is going to go. And and that to me is the loudest statement about how far apart these two teams are. And like you talked about how the Clippers don't really have an answer for Jokic. Well, it's not like Jokic is the kind of guy who's going to go out and drop 60. You know, right. He's not going to go out and score 50 points. The way that Jokic beats you is by making the right and the perfect pass every time. But if that perfect pass is going to Torrey Craig, then the Clippers are willing to live with that. So, and then, you know, there was a stretch where poor Jamal Murray, like you just talked about earlier, he went from being guarded by Donovan Mitchell and Joe Ingles sometimes and Royce Freeman too. There was a three possession stretch where it started with Patrick Beverley, and then he was guarded by Paul George. And then he was guarded by Kawhi Leonard. And I just felt bad for the guy. You know, what do you do there? Do you just throw your hands up in the air? Those are three of the best perimeter defenders in the league right now. And then in Kawhi's case, maybe the best perimeter defender we've ever seen.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right about Jokic. Like, you almost dare him to beat you as a scorer. Because you say, like, we will shut you down as a passer. You know, we're, again, going back to, like, you're going to take away your opponent's strength. Well, the strength is not Jokic as a scorer. Like, he can put up 30, but he's still going to do more damage because he also had 12 rebounds and 9 assists. If you let him put up 30, but you limit his impact on the glass and you limit his impact as a playmaker, then the Nuggets offense is going to get stagnant. And they're going to have to create more on their own one-on-one, as you said, against, you know, three of the best perimeter defenders in the NBA. Good luck. And, you know, from the Clippers side, like, Kawhi Leonard has just been quietly sensational so far throughout the playoffs, which is exactly what you would expect from Kawhi Leonard. Paul George has been hit or miss, but, you know, he had a much better performance in Game 5 against the Mavericks and, you know, 19 points on 6 of 13 shooting. That's fine for a number two option. Great. But, like, the Clippers also have, if one of those two guys don't have it going, you know, Marcus Morris was 7 of 10 overall, 18 points, 4 of 5 from deep. They didn't even really need Montrezl Harrell or Lou Williams. They combined for 25 off the bench. But, you know, they have that ridiculous amount of depth to go with their two stars as well. So even if one of their stars or both of their stars have an off night, they'll still have a chance because of their supporting cast offensively and then their defense as well. And, I mean, personnel-wise, I just don't know. The Nuggets just don't have anyone that can really, like, Jeremy Grant's probably your best option against Kawhi and Paul George, but he could only guard one of those two. You know, Gary Harris is coming back from the injury, great perimeter defender, but he doesn't have the size really to match up with either one of those guys. So I just don't think the Nuggets have the personnel necessarily to really counteract what the Clippers are going to do.
Yeah, I mean, it all basically comes down to, like, the kind of player that it takes to – you don't stop Kawhi Leonard, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the kind of player that is best equipped to at least make him work for it is bigger than he is and won't get worn down. It's like you see it. Kawhi doesn't have some crazy handle, right? He's not shifty. He does enough to move you, and then he attacks that weak shoulder when you move in the wrong direction. And he's so strong that once he gets a shoulder by you, you're not ever going to knock that shoulder off its course. And then, you know, you think, because he has such a high release point, that's what makes him such a great mid-range shooter, is that, all right, well, I'm not going to be able to contest him at the top of a shot. Well, maybe if I try to strip him on his way up, but he holds the ball like a golf ball. So there's not really a place to really affect where he's going to be holding the basketball. So, like, what you really need to do is find somebody who won't get knocked backwards when he tries to, and then is also ideally able to contest at the top of the shot and make him think about it. And you think about the players who are equipped to do that. Right now, it's like AD, Giannis, maybe Draymond, and that's about it. You know, there aren't very many, and none of those guys play for the Nuggets. And even like Jeremy Grant, like you mentioned, he's so slight of frame. He's a very athletic guy. He has the length that you would think could bother Kawhi, but he gets knocked back every time Kawhi so much as looks at him. So. It's a terrible matchup for the Nuggets. This is the kind of thing that I think they knew. Like, I think they started playing with house money after having beaten the Jazz. And I think at this point they're just saying, can we make this a 5-game series instead of a 4? Can we make it a 6-game series instead of a 5?
I totally agree with you. I mean, I think, you know, Michael Porter Jr. eventually has the frame and the length and the size to be that type of defender, but he's just nowhere there in terms of his awareness. I mean, he got roasted throughout that Jazz series as well. Yeah. So, you know, like, one day, look ahead a couple of years and maybe Michael Porter Jr. is that answer. But, you know, I think you're right. The Nuggets are playing with house money at this point, but, you know, they had to know that the Clippers were just the absolute worst matchup for them. And yeah, I mean, it's tough to imagine this series. Will the Clippers blow them out by 20 plus points every night? I don't necessarily think so, but I mean, I think back, I think it was right after the trade deadline, right before the All-Star break. I think it was right after they got Marcus Morris and they played the Nuggets, and it was the same type of thing. They just absolutely boat raced them. And, it was like that was the wake-up call for a lot of the league who, you know, all year the question was like, okay, well, when are the Clippers going to turn it on? Like, they played well against the Lakers in these marquee showcase games, but, like, when are we going to start seeing this on a night-to-night basis? And that Nuggets game was like, oh, this is the fully realized version of the Clippers. And now I think, you know, we're going to see that a lot in this series, and it's probably going to give them a lot of confidence going into the Western Conference Finals, regardless of whether the Lakers or the Rockets advance.
Yeah, I think it basically, whether or not the Clippers just go out and boat race them for four straight games, this is all going to be dependent upon how badly the Clippers want to go out and boat race them. Like, if they play a close game, it'll be because the Clippers, like, did a bunch of dumb stuff because they were bored, because they know they can beat the crap out of the Nuggets whenever they want.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you know, looking ahead, like, man, I don't know if any team has won more in the last week than the Clippers, just with, you know, the Bucks falling apart like this. I think that was really their scariest matchup. You know, of course, if the Lakers advance in the Western Conference Finals, that won't be easy. But, you know, like, looking ahead to whichever team gets out of the West and represents the West in the finals, like, the Bucks had that size. They had Giannis. Like, that posed a real threat to the Clippers. But now if we're talking, like, Boston or Miami, I mean, I think the Clippers match up pretty well against both of those teams. Like, it's hard to be... I haven't checked what the, like, updated NBA title odds right now, but I feel like
they're favorites.
Yeah, they should be.
Well, I think they're literally now, I think they announced it right after the Lakers lost, that the Clippers are now, like, the odds-on favorite to win the championship.
Yeah, okay. That tracks. That is exactly what they should be.
Yeah, I actually think, though, both the Heat and Celtics have enough length and physicality to make things interesting. Basically, what it takes to beat the Clippers is to beat the Clippers. Like, to go out there and get physical with them. When Marcus Morris goes out there and throws his cheap shot, you have somebody right behind him to throw a cheap shot at him. You know, you basically have to get into a dogfight against those guys. And, like, the Nuggets aren't that kind of team. Even Dallas wasn't really that kind of team. Quite frankly, a lot of the Lakers aren't quite like that. So, you know, like, the Celtics have Marcus Smart. I think Jaylen Brown is down for that kind of a game. Jason Tatum isn't really that physical, but he's skilled enough to you know, kind of make up for it a little bit. You have, you know, friggin' Miami is just nothing but those kinds of guys, right, with Bam and Jimmy Butler, who wakes up and, like, his warm-up is actually boxing somebody. So yeah. So I think those two matchups are definitely interesting. But yeah, I mean, the Clippers, this second round could not have opened up much better for them.
Yeah, for sure. Let's wrap up quickly then, talking about some coaching news. I think this was Thursday morning. I woke up for work and literally had to, like, double check on Twitter that someone did not just retweet a fake Woj, because this tweet comes through at, like, 9:30, and it says the Brooklyn Nets have hired Steve Nash as their next head coach. And it was, like, so out of the blue, you know, you just hadn't even heard him mentioned as a possibility. They're keeping on Jacques Vaughn as an assistant coach. But what was your reaction to this news?
Well, I mean, there's a few things. First and foremost, I think my first kind of response was, if this means that, like, Hall of Famers are now going to be interested in coaching, that's interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Because right after Steve Nash says he's interested, you get the whole, well, Chauncey Billups says he's interested, right? And if Chauncey Billups is interested, like, how far down the line does this go? Or up the line does this go? Mm-hmm. I think Steve Nash's first call was to Dirk Nowitzki, which by the way, doesn't really speak very well of where Steve Nash's priorities lie. I know it's fun to think, like, it'd be great to get those guys back on the sideline, but a coach like Nash probably really needs as much experience next to him as possible. So Dirk being his first call felt a lot like Luke Walton calling Jesse Mermes twice. for now, the conversation, though, with Nash turned very quickly to leapfrogging and the concept of, you know, white coaches getting more opportunities or different opportunities than African-American coaches. And I think it's a very – it's the kind of subject that you have to be very nuanced about, because – if you're just looking at it from a standpoint of white coaches, you know, or white basketball players are getting opportunities that black basketball players are not, the math and the experience lately would point to that not really being the case, right? Jason Kidd, essentially right when he retired from basketball, was offered any number of choices to play. Isaiah Thomas before him didn't have any coaching experience, and then immediately took over for the Knicks, and that went really well. Derek Fisher, also with the Knicks, right, was given that opportunity. So if you're just looking at it from like a black and white standpoint, I think you're going to be missing a few aspects of the conversation. What I will say, though, is how the whole concept of a coaching tree, to me, is where I think we need to look a little bit closer for the issues here, because Ime Udoka is somebody who has had enough experience alongside Pop that he should probably have been given an opportunity to coach his own team. Becky Hammon is somebody who has now been Pop's right-hand woman and has not really come close to being given an opportunity there. And so if we're going to be, like, every time, whether it's Mike Budenholzer, Jim Boylan, right, when it's a white man who is, you know, falling from the Greg Popovich or any coaching tree, really, that's the first inclination, is that coach is the real hot commodity. We saw that with Luke Walton and Steve Kerr previously, and again we saw how well that has gone. So, like, I while I understand why there are, like, Jock Vaughn has a real reason to be pissed. Because here he is, he got his team to play really hard and play really well in the bubble, and his the form of gratitude that he's given as a result of that is best of luck, bud, you know, and right, and that really sucks. So I think there's aspects, and really in all of coaching across all the sports, I think it's a very imperfect science on what we consider valuable for, you know, first-time head coaches. And then lastly here, and I think this is the biggest and most important factor, is that this seems like Nash was somebody who Kevin Durant singled out as the guy he wanted to be his coach. And that, to me, is the biggest factor here as far as why Steve Nash was hired. And at the end of the day, like, we're seeing it here with the Lakers, where I would much rather have Alex Caruso play all the point guard and all of Rajon Rondo's minutes. But if LeBron James and Anthony Davis want Rajon Rondo to play, then unfortunately that means Rajon Rondo is going to play. And in this era of superstar empowerment, we also have to identify, you know, some of those moments. Like, in my opinion, one of the criticisms that we should have been making all along with the superstar empowerment is that, like, yeah, it's great that LeBron James is empowered enough to be able to force Anthony Davis's way to the Lakers, but Josh Hart is African American, Brandon Ingram is African American, Lonzo Ball is half African American, and not much empowerment there for those guys. They had to live through that entire experience. And so while I fully support athletes vying for control that they really should have had all along, there are going to be some growing pains here. And I think this is one of those spots where the growing pain is, unfortunately, Jock Vaughn gets the raw end of the raw, or gets a pretty raw deal here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think your point about KD and Kyrie specifically singling out Nash is salient here because, I mean, KD had experience working with him with the Warriors. And, you know, that once the Nash news came out, people started recirculating this quote from Kyrie. I think it was from 2015. But he clearly has a lot of reverence for Steve Nash as well. And obviously the fact that the two play the same position would suggest that Nash should be able to be a good mentor for him in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the Nets, when they signed KD and Kyrie last summer, they basically conceded that we are turning our team over to you. They don't sign DeAndre Jordan to a 4-year, $40 million deal, despite having Jarrett Allen on the roster. You know, no one does that. It says like, oh yeah, we have Jarrett Allen, but we're going to spend $10 million a year for the next 4 years on DeAndre Jordan, who is a worse, more limited player, unless this was, well, this is what our two star players want.
And then also fire Kenny Atkinson or at mm-hmm. least part ways with Kenny Atkinson, because Jordan is the worst player, right? The reason Atkinson probably had a problem with the way things were going is because they were demanding maybe that Jordan get more of those minutes when Allen is a better player. If I were Atkinson, I'd say, fine, you know what? I'm going to get a job somewhere else. Y'all can, you know, have best of luck there with your washed up DeAndre Jordan.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you're spot on. It's like the player empowerment movement has pros and cons, but from the Lakers' perspective, as you said, it's great that LeBron James came there and lured Anthony Davis there, but there are drawbacks that we are seeing as well. And you have to kind of figure out how to toe that line between, okay, you want, you know, you don't bring in Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and then make all of your other decisions independent of them. You want their input. Yeah. You want their feedback. You need to know, like, especially because they're new to the team, like, what's going to maximize your talent? Like, how can we work best with you? And you want their feedback, but at the same time, you do need to take an objective approach and say, okay, well, thank you for your input, but we're also going to listen to other decision makers here. It's a tricky line to balance. So, you know, I think for Nash's perspective, you're taking an obvious risk because you have no idea what Steve Nash looks like as a head coach since he's never done it before. So I think it's good that they kept Vaughn on, you know, as an assistant to have that experience just with the day-to-day. Like, someone needs to literally walk him through what is the day-to-day life as a head coach. He's never done it before. It's like,
yeah,
you would not throw someone straight, you know, like, out of college into being a doctor. Like, they go to medical school for a reason. They need training. So it's good to have someone with that experience there for Nash. But, you know, at the same time, I was thinking about this the other day with respect to Bud, and I don't think it's fair to, like, reduce this to this is the only reason why it's happened. But I think it is interesting that in the last 5 years, every single team that won the NBA championship had a first-time head coach. Steve Kerr, Ty Lue, and now Nick Nurse last year. Like, Pop back in 2014 was the last one who had a lot of coaching experience when he won the title. And I do wonder if, like, we often make this argument for players, like, instead of going through, you know, retreads, like, why not try to find the next Duncan Robinson or someone, mm-hmm. you know, like the next Terrence Davis. So maybe it's the same deal with coaches. Like, instead of going, as you said, like, from Tom Thibodeau or Jeff Van Gundy or Mark Jackson for the 17th time, like, take a gamble and take a leap and see if Steve Nash, who is an incredibly cerebral player, like, you know, this is an all-time great player we're talking about. It's not like some eighth man scrub who played 3 years and then got kicked out of the NBA. Like, this is a very, very smart player. Like, let's see what he brings to the table and let's compliment him with guys who have the experience to, you know, see if we can figure out how to maximize these two all-world talents that we have on our roster.
Yeah, I mean, I've always kind of thought that the most successful coaches in the NBA are more CEOs than they are, like, middle management, you know, where all right, their job is to oversee everybody, but you have your defensive guy or person, and you have your offensive person, then you have your, you know, your training staff over there and your conditioner, your individual trainer, you have your shooting coach, right? And your job as a coach is to make sure that all of that stuff is running smoothly and optimized. And then also, by the way, very important here, maintaining positive relationships with your most important employees. In this case, it would be mm-hmm. Kyrie and Kevin Durant. And this is where I think Nash does have a bit of an advantage, is that he knows going in, and the Nets know going in, that at the very least, he's going to have a positive relationship with those two guys, and everything else can kind of fall into place after that. It's just, for me, what I'm really looking, you know, what I think is going to be a very early indicator in terms of how successful Nash is going to be, is who does he hire to have next to him? Will he go out and get Alvin Gentry? Will he go out and get some, you know, Nate McMillan? Will he go out and get, you know, these guys who probably should be head coaches, and yet brings them in so that they can all kind of work together under this umbrella? That to me is how these relationships and the best coaches make all this work in the NBA. And it's fascinating to see whether or not he's able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the relationship, like, ego management is among the toughest job of any coach, especially when you have superstars on your roster and you're balancing, you know, KD and Kyrie and now DeAndre Jordan are like the newcomers, and you still have like the homegrown Caris LeVert, Spencer Dinwiddie, Jared Allen, that type. So like meshing those competing factions together and like harnessing those relationships, I think it's going to be among Nash's biggest challenges. But as you said, the fact he has a pre-existing relationship with both guys is great. One of the questions is going to be like, okay, great, you're buddy-buddy with KD and Kyrie, that's wonderful, but like, you know, if you're down game six and like Kyrie's playing like crap, are you willing to light into him at that point?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like Ty Lue is now infamous because in game seven of the 2016 finals, like, he told LeBron James to play harder. And it was like, LeBron was like, what are you talking about? I just brought our team back from down 3-1. Like, I'm doing everything. He's like, I don't care, play harder. And LeBron like got pissed and stormed out of the locker room. But, you know, he ended up winning that series. And afterward, LeBron was like, look, I didn't agree with it at the time, but I respected Ty Lue. And it was like, all right, you know what? Fine. Like, I will. So, you know, will Steve Nash have that kind of respect coming in, and will he be willing to challenge those guys in particular? Because that's the thing, like, those two need to be the tone setters for this organization. Like, they are your two best players. If they're dogging it during the regular season, are you gonna like light into them, or are you just gonna let that, you know, are you gonna be complacent and like say that's fine? Because that's gonna have a trickle-down effect.
Yeah, I mean, that's why friends don't go into business very often, right? Because sometimes with friendships, you aren't always, do you put your friendship ahead of what needs to be said or done for the betterment of the business? And that's where this is going to be really tested. They have a great relationship now, but, you know, when Kyrie Irving has taken four straight ISO pull-up mid-range jumpers and Kevin Durant is sitting over there like, guys, I'm, you know, so long as he's healthy, by the way. You know, he's sitting over there like, you know, I'm the better player, I should probably have the ball more here. Right. You know, will Nash be able to say what needs to be said to Kyrie? And the same thing, you know, the other way around, where there's going to be stretches where maybe the Nets need to put Kevin Durant in like the pick and pop, and he might not want to set screens and stuff like that. Will Nash be able to pull KD aside and say, hey man, you need to go out there and you set screens? And will Kevin Durant then take to Twitter to send an emo tweet about how much he hates his head coach? Like, I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I can't wait to watch. But yeah, it was actually kind of a bummer to see this kind of whittled down to the place that it kind of immediately went to first, because I think it's such an interesting hire, and it's also a natural evolution of this era of player empowerment. And one thing that I think smart teams are going to have to figure out, and the teams that are going to be the most successful are going to figure this out the fastest, is finding a way to empower the player, but also have that relationship be a partnership, like you were talking about earlier. And there are going to be times where, like, organizationally, the Nets should have told, you know, the Lakers. Organizationally, the Lakers should, you know, be able to tell LeBron and AD, I don't give a crap what swag you think he brings to the table. Stop making Frank Vogel say swag and let him play the better player. And I think here with the Nets, it's not like maybe Nash is the event is the example eventually if it doesn't work out. But and that's another one, is like, if Nash is bad, will the Nets have permission from Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving to fire Steve Nash? Because that's another potential outcome to this. And so I think, you know, to bring all this kind of full circle, if you are going to go into business with these superstars, you have to do so with the first priority being finding a way to fully partner with those players, not where they have all of the power and you just enable all of their tendencies, good and bad, and not to the point where the superstar feels like they don't have enough power. Because, like, I'm sure Giannis right now doesn't feel like he has enough power. He should be able to go tell Bud, hey, dude, I'm going to go play five more extra minutes in this game and there's nothing you can do about it, okay? Okay. And if Giannis doesn't feel like he can do that, then that power relationship is out of whack too. So, you know, it's really interesting, the evolution and the interpersonal relationships that all these teams are going to be going are in with their superstars. The teams that figure it out the best are going to be the most optimized partnerships between everybody involved.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a good way to wrap it up. So, Anthony, thank you again for joining us today. One more time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter?
I'm at Anthony Irwin LA. I'm usually the person people are yelling at for no fault of my own. I don't even know why people get so angry at me over this stuff. And then you can find my show everywhere you find podcasts. It's Locked On Lakers. And then I also Friday nights host Locked On NBA with Adam Mattis.
Nice. Well, yeah, please give Anthony a follow. It'd be nice if the Lakers continue playing Rajon Rondo inexplicably.
Don't be nice. Let it rip. The meaner people are about Rajon Rondo, the higher the likelihood maybe that the Lakers pay attention.
Oh, there you go. That's a good way of looking at it. Well, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined today by Anthony Irwin. Anthony, have a good rest of your weekend, my man.
You too, man. Be safe.
Thank you. You too.